Coming up, the missing idea in the healthcare debate, a conversation with medical ethicist Daniel Callahan. Also, the church in Leipzig in what was then communist East Germany, where people were free to pray and hear the Gospels. They then went out to march in demonstrations that helped bring down the Berlin Wall 20 years ago. Plus, the Mormon Church is rebuilding downtown Salt Lake City. Some residents like the plan, others think the result will be too squeaky clean.
It's going to fundamentally change the nature and the whole culture of that part of downtown.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious leaders are calling for calm in the wake of the shootings at Fort Hood, Texas. The gunman was an American-born Muslim, an Army major, a psychiatrist, who had complained about being harassed for his faith. Islamic leaders especially urged the public to refrain from judging all Muslims. The Council on American-Islamic Relations condemned the attack and said no religious ideology could justify such violence. Conservative religious leaders have welcomed Election Day results in Maine, where gay marriage was rejected. 53% of voters there decided to repeal a law allowing same-sex marriage that had been approved by the legislature earlier this year. The Roman Catholic Church led the opposition to the law, and church officials said the referendum upheld the true nature of marriage. Gay rights advocates did see a victory in Washington State. There, voters upheld a law extending marriage benefits to gays and lesbians in civil unions. In Washington, D.C., Patriarch Bartholomew, spiritual leader of the world's 275 million Orthodox Christians, met with President Obama. The closed-door meeting focused on discussions of religious freedom and environmental stewardship. Bartholomew is known as the Green Patriarch and spent much of his time in the U.S. lobbying for stronger environmental policies. He told an audience at Georgetown University that he was alarmed by the disregard for the survival of God's creation. Other religious leaders also mobilized around environmental issues this week. On Capitol Hill, faith leaders lobbied Congress to make climate change legislation a high priority. Church World Service organized the effort that asked legislators to agree to reduce pollution. As concerns about the H1N1 virus continue to rise, authorities in Saudi Arabia are developing new precautions for the upcoming Hajj. Kim Lawton reports.
2.5 million Muslims from around the world are expected at the end of the month for the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. And international health officials are worried that could lead to a new swine flu epidemic. The Saudis have asked pregnant women, children under 12, and the elderly not to make this year's Hajj. They've also urged all Muslims to get vaccinated before they come, but vaccines are scarce in most countries. New guidelines advise pilgrims to bring hand sanitizers. But because Islam forbids alcohol, some Muslims don't want to use the sanitizers. Religious shrines in other parts of the world urge believers to wear face masks, but that also presents complications for the Hajj. Male pilgrims are not supposed to wear anything with stitches, and female pilgrims are supposed to keep their faces uncovered. Islamic authorities are issuing special fatwas, or edicts, saying it would be all right to wear the masks. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
As Congress assembles a health care reform package, a longtime expert on medical ethics writes in a recent issue of Commonweal magazine that there's been an important idea missing from the debate, the concept of the common good. The expert is Daniel Callahan, founder and now president emeritus of the Hastings Center. His new book is Taming the Beloved Beast. He joins us from New York. Mr. Callahan, welcome. How do you define the common good?
I mean by the common good our life together, the stranger and the neighbor, the friend we know and the person, people we don't know. The common good, I think of as essentially a social concept. Aristotle said human beings are social animals, and I think that is true. And it seems to me that as we think about our own life, either in politics or health reform, we have to think not only of ourselves and our family, but also of the neighbor, the stranger, the person we don't know, and somehow knit that together into some meaningful whole.
And was there a time in this country's history when the idea of the common good was very strong, very prevalent?
Well, in a curious sense, it's not. Europe has been has a much stronger sense of the common good, in great part because of their wars and other terrors they've gone through. In this country, I think there's been ambivalence and uncertainty about the common good. Freedom has been our main catchword, the main value we've gone by. Justice, a little bit less so. But the idea of working together for the common good is something. It certainly has come out in times of warfare, but it's sporadic. It often doesn't mark our common life together. And a great number of people, really, I think, are just enormously ambivalent. They want to help the poor, but of course they don't want to raise their taxes. They like health care reform, and they see the need for cutting costs, but they don't want to give up anything themselves. So we're very torn on the common good, I think.
Is that why it's been so difficult to put together health care reform, because nobody wants to give up anything?
That's a very powerful part of it. Now, some of it is different politics. Republicans and Democrats differ on the role of government. But it's very striking that even the Democrats, who started out talking about cost control, immediately back down and say, of course, we can't take anything away from people. But, of course, we can't control costs unless we do, unfortunately, take some things away from people.
And that's the idea in your new book, Taming the Beloved Beast, isn't it? That technology, medical technology, has become so important but also so expensive that there have got to be some kind of limits, some kind of controls. Is that right?
Exactly right. Technology is probably the main thing that drives up health care costs in this country. Everybody loves it. Doctors love it. Patients love it. It's part of American culture. And it's done wonderful things. It keeps us alive longer, keeps us healthier. Yet at the same time, the cost of it all is beginning to really corrode, even destroy the healthcare system. It's one of those wonderful cases of when is enough enough, and when does a good thing turn into a bad thing?
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, are we going to get a good, or in your judgment, a good healthcare reform?
I think we'll get a good reform in the sense that we'll probably see a much enlarged coverage of the uninsured, and we'll see some changes, improvement in health care for children, Medicaid. At the same time, we will not be able to control costs under the present bill, and I think that's going to create enormous problems in the very immediate future.
Daniel Callahan of the Hastings Center, many thanks. In other news, the Vatican and many Italians reacted angrily to a European court ruling that orders the removal of crucifixes from public school classrooms. After an atheist parent complained, the European Court of Human Rights said such an overt religious symbol in a schoolroom could upset non-Christian students. Vatican officials said they were shocked and saddened by the ruling. Italian officials said they would appeal. 20 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down, and so did communism in Eastern Europe, and quickly thereafter in the Soviet Union. In Leipzig, in what was then East Germany, people are remembering the church and the courageous pastor who provided freedom for people to meet and study the Gospels. They then spilled out into the streets to demand political freedom in their country. Deborah Potter reports.
St. Nikolai Evangelical Lutheran Church hasn't changed much since the 16th century. Bach once played the organ here, and the music is still a draw. But on this day, the tourists have come to hear about the church's more recent history from the man who led it through a difficult time. Christian Führer became pastor here in 1980 when the world outside the church was divided by the Cold War and Germany was split in two, most visibly by the wall the East German government built in Berlin in 1961. The communist state was determined to keep more of its people from escaping to the free West. In the German Democratic Republic, the GDR, atheism was the norm. Churches like St. Nikolai were spied on, but stayed open.
In the GDR, the church provided the only free space. Everything that could not be discussed in public could be discussed in church. And in this way, the church represented a unique spiritual and physical space in which people were free.
In the early 80s, Führer began holding weekly prayers for peace. Every Monday, they recited the Beatitudes from the Sermon on the Mount. Few people came. But in the late 80s, as the Soviet Union opened up to the West, more East Germans began to demand change, including the right to leave. And in Leipzig, they gathered at St. Nikolai, which proclaimed itself open for all.
The special experience that we had during the years of peace prayers and then with this massive number of non-Christians in the church, which was exceptional, was that they accepted the message of Jesus.
As a college student, Silke Schumann was one of the hundreds and then thousands who joined the vigils in the sanctuary and marched in the streets holding candles.
Seeing all these people gather in this place and then from week to week, getting more and more people gathering, you had the feeling this time really the government had to listen to you.
In October 1989, on the 40th anniversary of the GDR, the government cracked down. Protesters in Leipzig were beaten and arrested. 2 days later, St. Nikolai Church was full to overflowing for the weekly vigil. When it was over, 70,000 people marched through the city as armed soldiers looked on and did nothing.
In church, people had learned to turn fear into courage, to overcome the fear and to hope, to have strength. They came to church and then started walking, and since they did not do anything violent, the police were not allowed to take action. They said, "We were ready for anything, except for candles and prayer."
And I remember it was a cold evening, but you didn't feel cold? Not just because you saw all the lights, but also because you saw all these people. And it was, you know, it was really amazing to be a part of that. And you felt so full of energy and hope. For me, it still gives me the shivers thinking of that night. It was great.
Just 1 month after that massive demonstration, the wall between East and West here in Berlin came down. The church had sent a strong message. The East German government no longer controlled its people. The joy and relief on that day 20 years ago became reality thanks in part to the effort of one tenacious pastor and what he describes as his firm faith in this teaching of Jesus. Blessed are the peacemakers.
If any event ever merited the description of miracle, that was it. A revolution that succeeded. A revolution that grew out of the church. It is astonishing that God let us succeed with this revolution.
Führer, who retired last year at age 65 as required by his church, has written a book about those historic days. St. Nikolai itself has gone back to being a parish church, its congregation not much larger than before. But Führer says he didn't do what he did back then to draw people to the church. In his words, "We did it because the church has to do it." For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Deborah Potter in Leipzig.
Now a special report on the rebuilding of Salt Lake City. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, are building an enormous new downtown development, high-end shops, condos, and offices. Is that emphasis on wealth and consumerism compatible with Mormon values of modesty and thrift? Does it leave any room for the poor or for the variety that helps make up vibrant city life? Lucky Severson reports from Salt Lake City.
By the looks of things, downtown Salt Lake City has found a pot of gold at the end of the stimulus rainbow. Where else would you find 1,600 construction workers on a project so immense it will transform the core of a city? But this is not stimulus money, not even 1 cent of local taxpayers' money. This project, known as City Creek Center, is funded entirely by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, and their development partners. Stephen Goldsmith was the city planning director during the Salt Lake Olympics.
This is unprecedented. This is the single largest private development project going on in the United States today.
When it's completed in 2012, the new city center, directly across the street from the church's temple, will include millions of square feet of retail and office space. Only the church knows the price tag, and they declined to be interviewed for our story. But the project's cost is expected to top $1.5 billion, a price they're willing to pay to transform Salt Lake City. Natalie Gochner is chief operating officer of the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce.
We have the headquarters of an international religion. We've hosted the world in the Olympics. So we want to build a world city.
But some Salt Lake residents are worried whether that world city will make room for non-Mormons. Outsiders often don't know that in the city itself, a majority of residents are not Mormon. And some locals are concerned that the diversity of a vibrant downtown will give way to a squeaky clean Mormon enclave in City Creek Center. Daniel Darger owns a Blue Iguana restaurant not far from Temple Square.
There's no question in my mind it's going to fundamentally change the nature and the whole culture of that part of downtown. I think that primarily their goal is to get a lot of their members here and to gain control of not only the politics, which they already have, and the economy, which they already have, but the atmosphere of the whole downtown.
Before the City Creek project got underway, not many would have thought of Salt Lake as a world city. It was losing its population to the burbs. Downtown was becoming a ghost town, and that wasn't good for business or the church's image. Albert Peck is a former editor of Sunstone Magazine, an independent journal for Mormon intellectuals.
When I was a child, I remember coming downtown with my grandmother, and she'd walk all of Main Street, stopping off at every little shop and every little boutique. It's a wonderful, vibrant downtown.
But in the late 60s, Salt Lake began to face a suburban flight that was sweeping the nation. In an effort to reverse the trend, the church developed two downtown malls on land across from Temple Square. Rather than revitalizing the street life, though, the enclosed malls drew shoppers into the parking garage and then sent them right back to the suburbs, leaving the rest of downtown in bad shape.
Salt Lake City was dying, and the city was becoming seedy. And our image and promotion is very important to the missionary work of the church.
The church is again trying to revive the streets around Temple Square. And now, to get people out of their cars, they've got TRAX, an increasingly popular light rail system that was built 10 years ago. Ryan McFarland is the economic development manager for the city's mass transit system.
Transit-oriented development is just this. It is a walkable community that's typically higher density and that provides for all of your needs.
Strongly opposed at first, TRAX, up and running, is now warmly embraced. The church strongly encourages its downtown employees to use mass transit, and the new development will be serviced by two TRAX stations.
This is the core of downtown. This is the city center station. This will be the central business district where people don't necessarily need their car.
From the beginning, Mormons have been pioneers in the field of city planning. Even before Joseph Smith was assassinated, they planned and built the city of Nauvoo, Illinois, which at the time rivaled the metropolis of Chicago. Only Nauvoo was designed around the church's temple, which is center to Mormon theology. Salt Lake City was designed in the same fashion. The new plan, though, is a little different. It incorporates the church's values and old-fashioned capitalism. Jason Mathis is the executive director of the Downtown Alliance.
My sense is that right now, people are pretty enthusiastic about this, and even some of the critics in the past have said, well, we recognize this is going to be a really good thing for our community.
It's unlikely that a development of this magnitude would be possible in any other U.S. city because no one organization owns so much downtown property, and that will include satellite campuses for two church schools. As the church's influence expands in Salt Lake City, the interests of the non-Mormon community often conflict with those of the church, creating what Stephen Goldsmith calls a we-they divide.
The community needs to understand that we do have a certain Vaticanization, if you will, of this end of town. The changing demographics of Salt Lake City, just Salt Lake City by itself, really does create a we-they. There's more of a we-they in this community than I've seen in my lifetime.
The we-they divide became more pronounced a few years ago when the church purchased property adjacent to Temple Square and converted it into a private park known as the Main Street Plaza. That controversy grew to a full boil earlier this year when two men were found kissing in the plaza and were evicted by church security guards.
When we privatize the public way, which is the single most important things in cities, is that democratic space of streets and sidewalks, when we lose that, we begin to lose some of that democracy. Remember, this is now private property. City Creek Center will basically control time, place, and manner of anything that happens interior to that project. So if a couple who happens to be same-sex is kissing each other after buying a wedding ring, that could be a problem.
Critics worry that the church's social policies, such as abstention from alcohol, will dictate the city's culture. Jason Mathis says that Salt Lake is not Las Vegas and doesn't want to be, but the people here genuinely want to welcome other people.
It's something that we're really paying attention to, really trying to break down those barriers. I want people who might come downtown and go to a bar to also feel perfectly comfortable experiencing Temple Square in the way that Parisians might experience the Cathedral of Notre Dame, whether they're Catholic or not.
Even though the city has a non-Mormon mayor and non-members outnumber members, Salt Lake is surrounded by suburbs and towns that are heavily Mormon. People who will come to the new downtown and who rarely oppose what the church proposes, even when it hurts. That includes Janice Heilner.
When we go to the temple, everyone takes their street clothes off. They have locker rooms, and you can change into a white outfit.
Janice operated a successful store across from Temple Square called Dressed in White until the church moved her to another location to make room for the City Creek project.
I was disappointed, but I could see the greater good in the whole thing. I know we were a casualty of the whole downtown redevelopment, but I realized that downtown needed a facelift. The only reservation is, will I be able to go back? I mean, you know, a new mall is going to cost a lot of money. I might not be able to afford the rent.
Her reservation is probably realistic. City Creek, after all, is a for-profit private development which favors national chains and allows it to bypass the affordable housing requirements of public developments. Higher-end condos overlooking Temple Square could go for as high as $2 million.
They're trying to make it pay for itself, first of all, because the church doesn't like to put in money that it's going to lose. You can't fault them for that. But it's going to be a high-end mall, and it's going to be high-end apartments. But there needs to be addressed low-income housing in the city. That's for sure.
Stephen Goldsmith, the former director of city planning, is now an associate professor at the University of Utah who teaches a class about the ethics of shaping communities. He says he sees a disconnect between the business side of the church, which is constructing 900,000 square feet of retail space, and the values the church constantly preaches.
Some of those values are frugality, modesty, humility. And it's interesting to see how a temple to consumerism somehow is aligned with those values. What church do you know of that's building retail space anyplace else in the world?
Within the church, within the scriptures, there's a strong river of theology that is very anti-materialistic. And so there's a conflict there. It's the same conflict that Christians have with the New Testament. But Mormonism has pretty well made its peace with modern consumer, capitalistic, materialistic society. And Mormons have to deal with that individually.
There are parts of the development that almost everyone can agree on. City Creek is a green project with green buildings, recyclable water. And even though the recession has hurt most of the country, the City Creek project has sheltered Salt Lake from the worst of it.
People say there's no safe harbor from this recession, but in downtown Salt Lake City,
There is.
We're on high ground here.
I think that the church doesn't want to lose money on this, but I think that their motives have much more to do with being good community stewards, with creating a community that is going to last for the next 100 years.
As for those who have concerns,
God grant me the strength to know the things I can change and the things I can't. I think this is a time for the community to say, let's develop the kind of city that we want, let them develop the kind of city that they want, and maybe we can shake hands someplace along the way.
The church has said that the money for City Creek will come from investments and not from members' tithes. Funding for the project was reportedly set aside before construction began. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Salt Lake City.
That story was a collaboration between this program and Public Broadcasting's Blueprint America project. On our calendar this coming Thursday, Baha'is celebrate the birth of their founder, Baha'u'llah, in 1817. And that's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website. You can read Deborah Potter's extended interview with the pastor of St. Nikolai Church in Leipzig, and an excerpt from ethicist Daniel Callahan's new book on healthcare. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from a traditional Hindu celebration in India this week called Full Moon Day. Hindus believe lighting lamps brings prosperity and peace.